Dear listeners, Sai Ram and greetings from Prashant Nilayam. Welcome to our radio program, Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem from Team Radio Sai at 7:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time on Thursdays. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 31st August 2017. Have a listen, please.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, it's my pleasure to welcome you to yet another episode of Answering Booth, a show of questions and answers. Questions are yours, and answers we look for them together in Swami's message. Truly speaking, all the answers we need are within each one of us. But reading Swami's words and listening to what Swami has to say on different themes only helps us to discern this voice within. I won't say more on this topic. For the last week, I spoke extensively on this theme of listening to that voice within. But you all will agree with me that when you find an answer for a problem or a question that has been bothering you for quite a while, and then you have this feeling, my God, I was actually thinking in these same lines a while ago. Well, it fills us with a thrill we cannot explain, isn't it? For always, the solution we find outside in the words of the elderly and the wise, in the words of the masters and the scriptures, are only a reflection of what is within. That's why every search to be true and complete must lead us within. For it's not before we get done with the quote of the week on the Answering Booth show that we head to the questions for this week, isn't it? We do have an interesting question, which to an extent is an extension of a question that I had handled earlier. But let's get to that when we get to that. Now it's time for the quote. Today's quote is from Peter Shepherd, who I honestly don't know much about, but the quote is very interesting, and that's why I'm going to be reading it out for you on this show. I quote, "Love is unconditional acceptance. It is love for parents. It is love of parents for child. Also the non-possessive love of partners. Also the caring love between all people that enables forgiveness. It's above energy, though it may be expressed energetically. It's our essential nature, the spirit itself, the quality we share with God. And it is the binding force of the universe inherent in all that is." End of quote. So that quote is all about love. But the author refers to a few very significant attributes about this love that I've had the opportunity to speak on at different occasions earlier. But it's very interesting to see the way he has put it across. Pure love is the unconditional acceptance like what parents have for their children, and it is the non-possessive love that is there between partners in a relationship. Well, there's a sweet paradox in this. Have you ever wondered why you love your child so much? You celebrate the talents the child has. You adore the funny and cute things your child does. It's not because your child is the most talented in the neighborhood or the cutest in town. It all starts with this thought that here is my child. And because it is mine, the child is adorable. Love comes from possessiveness in this case. But yet, parents' love is very, very selfless. But when it comes to partners, possessive love actually becomes constricting. But even such worldly love can become pure when it becomes non-possessive. In that case, possessiveness leads to pure love. But here, love becomes pure when possessiveness is removed. Well, the secret is, in both cases, when worldly love becomes pure love, the possessiveness transmutes into oneness. From feeling the person I love is mine, to the feeling that the person I love is part of me. And I think I would not be wrong in saying that this feeling of oneness is certainly present in all of us. That is why, however hard-hearted we may be, when we see another in pain, our heart aches. When we see poverty, we cringe. And the author says, when someone hurts us, we are able to forgive because all wish to be forgiven ourselves. If we feel another's pain, why do people still go to bed hungry in this world? Why does one man inflict pain and suffering on another? Well, as the quote I read beautifully explains, love is beyond all energy, but still can and may I add, must be expressed energetically. Love is beyond words and expressions, but every opportunity we have, we must express love and bring love to the realm of action. Same is the case with devotion too, isn't it? The love we feel for Swami may be beyond expression, and yes, indeed it is. But if that love does not express in our actions as obedience to His words and respect to His wishes, the love loses the precious opportunity to become absolute. Making this love absolute is no different from self-actualization. For our true self is love. God is love. And that which binds all creation together is love. So when we do such actions that express this love and love alone, that in itself is a perfect life, the very goal of every spiritual journey. So dear listeners, before we head to the question of the week, permit me to read that quote of Peter Shepherd one more time. I quote, "Love is unconditional acceptance. It is love of parents for child, also the non-possessive love of partners, also the caring love between all people that enables forgiveness. It's above energy, though it may be expressed energetically. It's our essential nature, the spirit itself, the quality we share with God, and it is the binding force of the universe, inherent in all that there is." With that, dear listeners, it's time to head to the question of the week, and this week's question is from Brother Sai Deeksh from California. He's been living in California, US for a while now, and this is the question that he has sent to us.
Sai Ram, brother. First of all, thank you for providing this forum where we can ask all our trivial and praiseworthy questions and get insightful answers from you. My question is about a beautiful dream that I had of Swami and the strong message He conveyed through that dream. I consider this experience very personal to me and was just seeking a direct response from you. However, you gave merit to my question and felt this would be helpful to many devotees who are in the same boat as me. Keeping my question short, it was in 2011 that I came to United States. And in the same year, I got this dream where Swami very clearly told me, "Angrezon ke tarah mat sochna, mat karna." Meaning, do not think nor act like an Englishman. Well, I am not good in Hindi, and I am not sure why Swami spoke to me in Hindi, but I still got His message. It was wonderful to get this dream. However, my problem started immediately. I started to discriminate what was Indian or Bharatiya and Western or Angrez. I would be very glad if you could help me interpret this message in a more straight, clear and simple manner. Thank you once again, Sai Ram.
So that's the question from Brother Sai Deeksh. Before I venture into answering that question, a disclaimer. I don't want to get into this act of interpreting Swami's dreams. So going forward in future, if you are having any dreams about Swami, please don't send them to me and ask me to interpret them for you. I really am not in a position to do that. I am taking this particular question because the dream that he is referring to where Swami has said a particular thing is something which Swami would generally tell all of us, that we need to protect this Bharatiya culture that we've all grown up in, and we should not let it be eaten up. Literally, that's the word Swami used. Get eaten up and withered away by ideas which are modern or Western, if you could put it that way. And that's the reason I decided to take up this question. But I am not taking this up because I can interpret Swami's dreams. I don't think I'm in a position to do that. So going forward, please do not send me questions where you're asking me, what did Swami mean when He said this in my dream? And I'm just saying that as a general disclaimer. The other general disclaimer that I want to make is something which Brother Deeksh has himself mentioned in his question. When I'm trying to answer this question, I'm not going to tried to portray Indianness as something greater, or being an Indian as something being very special. Because much of what Swami speaks of when he's talking about Bharatiya culture and the Bharatiya nature is sadly not to be seen much in Indians themselves. So these are principles and these are qualities which are very, very special. In fact, even as I explain some of them, you'll realize that it's not like these qualities are not present in cultures other than Indian. In fact, these were qualities which were fundamental to most cultures and most countries. It's just that you would see that many of the traditions in India seem to have outlived time and seem to have weathered the changes that have happened. And Swami's discourses emphasize and point out to some of these things which are fundamental to a very good civilization, a very good culture. And Swami would encourage us to hold on to these principles in some form. You know, the externals might change, the way we go about our life changes. But if we can hold on to these fundamental principles and try to live with them, even in the changed circumstances, Swami would want us to do that. And it is in that context that I will be speaking about this. Of course, Swami would emphasize this, especially to Swami's students. So it was, I think, necessary to point it out as a fundamentally Indian way of living, right? But as you correctly pointed out, Brother Deeksh, none of these actions are or principles are Indian. These are good principles. These are principles which Swami would refer to as human values. And that is why it's important to not listen to my answer, or rather even think about this particular problem with the idea that, you know, what is it that makes Indians greater, and are Westerners or foreigners or Englishmen, are they any way lower than any of the Indians? It's not in that way. Swami endorses some of these qualities and aspects of Indian culture. So as Swami's devotees, just like how we look at the various other things that Swami says and ask ourselves, you know, what is it that I can do to please Swami? What is it that I can do to bring a change in my life so that Swami would like and Swami will be pleased by that? In the same manner, let's look at Indian culture and see what is it that Swami is fond of, what is it that Swami wants us to hold dear and try to practice in our life. In an earlier question, I had actually spoken extensively about this. There was a question that Ms. Praveena Kilpadi from Delhi had asked about why does Swami praise Indian culture so much? We don't see it in day-to-day life now. We are supposed to be a culturally rich society, but, you know, it doesn't show up in day-to-day life. So in that, I had spoken about what Swami refers to as the enduring principles of Indian culture, which are being passed on from generation to generation, but, you know, due to the various reasons, it's not showing up, and that's something which we need to work on. So I had spoken much about that. In some ways, the answer that I'm going to be giving today is going to be an extension of that. So if you have not heard that, I would suggest that you go back and listen to that too, that because I spoke about three or four fundamental principles which Swami refers to. But today for this question, I thought I'll take a different approach. I wanted to start with a chinna katha which Swami would narrate to our students and, of course, in general in his discourses. And this chinna katha precisely deals with what Brother Deeksh, Swami told you in your dream, that when you go abroad, when your work or your study or your profession takes you abroad, be sure that you protect the values which you imbibe through the Indian culture and come back an Indian, if I could put it that way. So let me tell this chinna katha, a beautiful chinna katha which Swami would narrate. There was this family of a mother, father and a son, a very orthodox family, a very religious family, where the father and the mother bring up this child, teaching him all these shlokas and the mantras in a traditional ways. You know, he goes to the temple every day and he's very respectful. And a typical orthodox, religious Indian family, a very well-cultured Indian family. So this boy at the age of about 22 or something, Swami says, he wants to go for his higher studies to a foreign country. So he comes up to his father and he expresses this desire. He says, I would like to go for a master's degree abroad. So the father is very happy. He says, definitely, my blessings are with you. You can go and come. So before going out, the parents are going to go and drop this boy at the airport. And before that, the father says, let us go to the temple of our family deity. It's supposed to be a form of mother goddess. So the father says, we'll go to that temple. You offer your prayers to her and then we will proceed towards the airport. So the mother, father and this boy go to the temple and the father starts praying to the mother saying that, oh goddess, I'm going to send my son abroad. Please take good care of him. May he not get into any trouble and all of that. So he makes this prayer to mother and this boy also joins the father in prayer. And of course, the father tells the son that offer gratitude to mother that she is giving you this opportunity to improve your knowledge. The son offers prayers, offers gratitude, and then they proceed towards the airport. And then Swami says at the airport, like how most children are expected to do, the boy touches the feet of the father and mother very reverentially, takes their blessings, and then goes abroad. He spends about 2 years or 3 years doing his higher studies in this foreign country, and then one day he is scheduled to return back after completing his studies. So the mother and father again go to the airport to receive this child who is coming back. They're very, very happy that the son is finally coming back. They go to the airport. And Swami says that this boy comes out of the airport a completely changed man. His mannerisms have changed. The way he went, he was completely different, right? So he comes out and he waves to his parents and he comes up to his mother and he says, hello, mommy, how are you? And he gives her a hug. He turns to his father and gives him a hug, gives him a handshake. He doesn't touch the parents' feet like how he did before he left. Swami says the mother is not very disturbed by that. She is very happy to see the son come back. So she's in tears and she's so happy. But the father notices this change, the change in behavior, that he no more seems to be showing reverence. So then they proceed towards home. Then the father says that before we go home, let us go to this temple and offer prayers to the mother goddess before we go home. So then they go to this temple and then Swami says that there is so much of disinterest in this boy's demeanor now. He's walking into the temple with his footwear. The father has to remind him that, you know, you have to leave your footwear outside. And the whole body language is different. He walks in very casually and, you know, the reverence which he showed before going was not there. Then he goes up to this sanctum sanctorum where the mother goddess, the idol, is there. So the father and mother fold their hands together and offer pranams. But this boy, what does he do? He looks at the idol and he says, hello, mommy, how are you? And he puts out his hand. You know, you should listen to it in Swami's voice. It's hilarious the way Swami puts it. And he looks at this mother goddess and she says, hello, mommy, how are you? And puts out his hand. And Swami says that at this point, the father loses it. The father gets so upset with the son, he gives him a tight slap and he said, you know, 22 years you lived here and we brought you up and we gave you sound culture and sound grounding in our religious beliefs. And you go out for 2 years and you come back like a foreigner. You know, what sort of behavior is this? How can you behave like this? So this is the story that Swami would tell us, would narrate to us when we were students. Multiple times I've heard it from Swami and we have discourses where Swami narrates this story. I'm sure it's there. And Swami would tell this to us as we were students and Swami would say, see, this is what it is. That how can a culture that has been imbibed in you for 20 years, 22 years, change completely when you are exposed to this modern culture for 2 years? And Swami would say that you should always ensure that this doesn't happen to you, because there were layers of meaning to that when Swami tells it to our students. Because apart from the fact that we are brought up in Indian culture, we are brought up in this culture of Swami's message and Swami's expectations, you know, when we were students. And it is quite possible that when we go out, we forget these values that Swami is very particular about. And Swami was telling us that it's very important that you don't lose these values that have been inculcated in you. So this is the Chinnakatha which Swami would say. And I would like to base my answer completely on this one Chinnakatha which Swami says. So I may not be comprehensive in saying that what are those things which make a person more rooted in that Indian culture. But I'm sure that much of what we need, we can learn from just this one Chinnakatha. First and foremost, the thing which Swami emphasizes is when he comes back, the way he behaves with his parents has completely changed, right? it does not necessarily show that he's become indifferent to his parents. Of course, Swami says that he shows so much of love. He comes and hugs his parents and all of that. But there is a change in the way he looks at his relationship with his parents. And what is that change? Swami would often say this, when the relationship between parents and children should have three components to it. Of course, there should be love. There should be love between the parents, should show love to the children, and the children should have love for their parents. That's very, very important. The second thing is, there should be a sense of reverence. Our love towards our parents should not just be very casual love. There should be a sense of reverence and respect in the love that we show to our parents. And the third thing is, there should be a sense of duty. So our relationship with our parents, Swami expects that it should have all of these three components. There should be love, there should be reverence, and there should be a sense of duty. And I'll speak of each one of these one by one. Why is it that this sense of reverence is important? The sense of love is probably quite easy because, we all love our parents. I don't think most of us fall in the category of people who we have a lot of love for our parents. But in the modern sense, there is this culture which is coming where parents try to become friends with their children, right? It's quite innocuous. There's nothing like this, something very bad about that. It seems like a very nice thing to do. Even all our popular media kind of portrays that as a cool thing to do, where you become very friendly to your children and your children can come and speak to you like you're their best friend. So they glorify that aspect of a friendly relationship between parents and friends. It is good. There is absolutely no doubt that that kind of a relationship is quite healthy. But we should not forget that Swami would often say that there is this Vedic mantra. It is considered something like the convocation address. When the children from the Gurukula are graduating out and leaving the portals of the Gurukula, they are given these dictums and this mantra is chanted. And one of the first few lines in that mantra is Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava. And Swami would say that this is essentially a fundamental nature of Indian culture, where it says that you have to look at your mother and father as respectfully as you look at God. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava. Consider your mother and father as God. Consider your guru as God. That's another aspect. I'll come to that. This feeling of reverence towards parents is a very, very important aspect of this relationship between a child and a parent. It is good to be friendly and all of that, but there are enough people whom we can be friendly with in the world, and there are enough people who can play that role of a friend in our life. We have colleagues, we have classmates, we have other friends which we meet. But this role of a parent is very, very specialized, very specific. It's probably one of the most onerous and the most responsible roles a person can play in his life when he is playing the role of a parent to a child. So it's very important for parents to realize this and not dilute this relationship to the extent where, it just becomes another form of friendship. There are enough friends for a child. You have to play the role of a parent. And that's why Swami would often say, very beautifully Swami would tell in the discourse, that when you bring up your children, there should be love, there should also be law. In the sense that you should enforce discipline, you should use to an extent that respect and that fear as a means of disciplining and bringing up the child in a right manner. This aspect of reverence towards parents is very, very important. This problem of converting a relationship into a form of friendship is a very modern way of looking at life, and it does not confine itself only to this relationship between children and parents. We try to do this in all our relationships. If you look at it keenly, the modern way of living is you go to the boss and you treat him like a friend. You treat your teachers like a friend. That's what I said, that Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava. You have to treat your teachers like God. That is the basis of Indian culture. But now the modern way of living is you treat your boss like a friend, you treat your teacher like a friend, you treat somebody who is twice or thrice your age like a friend, you call them by their first name. I'm not saying that the expression of friendship or love is wrong, but when that reverence which is necessary for a relationship is lost, then I think we end up diluting that relationship to a great extent. In fact, many of Swami's students, many of my classmates who would go abroad would say that. One of my friends was saying that he would be sitting at his desk and working, and every time the boss would walk up to his desk to say something, he would stand up and speak to the boss, because he would say that, you know, he's an elderly person and he is my boss at the end of the day. I have to respect that position that he is holding. So whenever this boss would come, he would stand up and speak to him, and the boss would say, no, you don't have to do that. You can just sit and talk. And the other colleagues would literally make fun of him. They would say that, you know, why are you showing that kind of respect to him? And are you trying to get favors from him? You know, that's the sort of feeling that they would have. But this boy would say that this is so natural to us. Someone who's elder to us and someone who's in a position which is above us, we naturally give that respect and reverence to that person. So this is a very important aspect of culture where, you know, we respect the age of the person, the role that person is playing in our life, be it that of a parent, that of a teacher, that of a senior, that of a elderly person in the neighborhood, or whatever it is. We respect that person according to the role that he is playing in our life at that moment. Even if he's a boss, even if he's an elderly person during a commute or whatever it is. So that reverence, yes, there should be love, yes, there should be friendliness, and along with that, that reverence and respect which is necessary for that relationship has to be maintained, right? And comes with this is a very, very beautiful point that you have to keep in mind. There is a subtle paradox in this. This does not necessarily mean that you forget that essentially we all are one, right? Because the basis of the entire Indian culture comes from the belief that each one is just like the other. We all are one. We all are bound by oneness. The duality is an illusion. But accepting that oneness as the essential basis on which all of us are interacting, yet you respect what we are in the physical frame as, you know, whatever position we are holding in life. The ability to strike that balance, I think, is a very, very important feature of Indian culture or Bharatiya tradition, where you don't forget the underlying oneness, because that underlying oneness is a given. It's an accepted fact. You don't debate about that. You don't deny that. But accepting that underlying oneness, you still respect people for their age, for their position, for whatever role they are playing in your life. So that is one aspect. So I spoke about the relationship with our parents having three from that story that I narrated. Love, reverence, and the third one is duty, which is again a very, very important aspect about Bharatiya culture, which Swami would often tell us. I recall a very beautiful incident which happened when we were students. We would have this tradition in the hostel that the batch which is becoming the senior most batch, when you're in your senior years, you give yourself, you give the batch a name by which you're referred to. So they would have batches like, oh, this batch is the Peace Pilgrims batch, or this batch is, all kinds of names. I don't recall now. So many kinds of Samaritans was one batch name which was there when I was a student. So each batch gives itself a name when they come to that final year, and they would refer to themselves as that, and they would do programs calling themselves that and all of that. So when it came to our turn, we decided that why not go and ask Swami for a name? Why not explain this concept to Swami, that Swami, each batch has a name, and would you like to, I mean, we'll be very, very happy if Swami can give us a name. So one of our students made bold and went and asked Swami this. He explained to Swami that there's a concept called the class name and all that. And he said, Swami, please give us a name. And Swami said, what kind of a name do you want? So this boy said, Swami, we would like to have a name which would inspire us and a name which comes from Indian culture, right? We essentially were telling Swami that we want a Sanskrit name. We want a name from Indian culture and that which can inspire us. And almost spontaneously, Swami said that if you want a name from Indian culture which represents Indian culture and which can inspire you till the end of your life's journey, the only word I can give you is dharma. That's the way Swami explained, and he gave us that name, and that's the name by which our class, we called ourselves the batch of Dharma, the order of Dharma, whatever it is. But it's a very beautiful lesson that Swami was teaching us, that if there is one word which conceptualizes or expresses all that is about Indian culture, and if there's one word which can inspire you to stick to the values of Indian culture, then that word is Dharma. Because that aspect of duty is a very, very important aspect that we tend to forget. And I mean, I have spoken many, many times in the course of many answers that I've given in the other programs that we do, we always refer to this, what Swami would say, that, you know, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is Mama Dharma. Answering this question, what is my duty at this point in time, is essentially what we have to do at every moment in life, and that's how we have to lead our entire life. And that aspect of duty, right, when I'm talking in the context of the relationship between children and their parents, this question of, you know, what is my duty towards my parents, that has to be always at the top of this relationship. That needs to be a very important component of this relationship. And it's not just about this relationship between parents and children. The parents should feel that towards their children. And each one, in whichever scenario they are in, this question has to be at the top of their mind. What is my duty towards the organization I'm working in? What is the duty towards probably the community I belong to? What is the duty towards the neighborhood I'm living in? What's the duty towards my society, my city, my nation? And even as I'm saying this, you would realize that this is something probably which is missing in most of us Indians itself. And that's why I said that when I say that these are essentially Indian qualities or Bharatiya qualities, it does not necessarily mean that we as Indians embody this. In fact, we as Indians are forgetting this, and that's something which Swami would very painfully speak of whenever he is speaking about Indian culture in his discourses. So this aspect of duty, what is my duty towards whichever organization or whichever conglomeration I am part of, it's an essential way of thinking of the Bharatiya culture, right? And when I say this, when there are many, many ways of which, many, many things that you can learn from this attitude, what I'm saying. But before that, you know, where does the sense of duty stem from? If you go back to that relationship between children and their parents, Swami says that this sense of duty is based on your sense of gratitude. It all comes from that. You know, children should feel grateful towards parents for giving them whatever they have given them. And that gratitude will give them a sense of duty. So a sense of duty is born out of a sense of gratitude. But sadly, you know, many, many children these days, you hear them say this thing, that when parents try to tell them that, you know, I went through so much of trouble to bring you up, the children very casually tend to say, you know, what's so great about that? You after all did your duty, right? You after all did what you were supposed to do. I mean, that is essentially the mistake that we are making. We have to always be grateful to what we receive. And probably at this point, I'll bring in the other paradox. I spoke about that paradox, a sweet paradox, or rather a balance that we have to strike, that we understand the oneness, but yet we honor the differences in society. The other paradox or the other balance that we have to strike when we are talking about Indian culture is this. Swami says there are two things that we have to do to sanctify our life. Right? Swami would say this, to sanctify our life and to purify our mind, there are two things that you have to do. One is, never remember what you do for others. And the other is, never forget what others have done for you. And when others have done for you, I mean, what is the good that others have done for you? So Swami would say, never remember the good that you have done to others. Never forget the good that you have received from others. Now, putting this in the context of, let's say, the role of a person in a family, you know, whenever he looks at his parents, he should never forget that he or she has received something from his parents. But whatever the son or the daughter does towards the parents, the person should not look at it as, you know, something that he is doing out of his way or out of her way. He should look at it as part of his duty, right? That is one way by which you don't remember the good that you've done for others. You don't give it too much importance. If you start thinking that, no, what I'm doing for my parents is what I'm supposed to do, it's part of my duty, there's nothing great about that, right? So this combination of a sense of duty and a sense of gratitude should govern every relationship that we have in the society, not just between parents and children. I explained it as in the case of parents and children, where you feel whatever good you do to your parents or whatever care that you give to them is part of your duty, but you never forget what you've received from them, and that will give you a sense of gratitude. And it helps both ways. You know, that gratitude, Swami says, will lead to a sense of duty. And the sense of duty will always make you forget what you've done for them, so it will also make you feel more grateful for what you've received. Now, let's take this to a completely different scenario. Let's take it probably in the organization setup between an employer and an employee. In the modern context, what has become of all of these relationships and all of these interpersonal interactions that we have in society is it has all become transactional, contractual, right? So that I do work, you pay me. I put in man hours and you pay me for that. Or this is my talent I bring to the table and you are giving me a remuneration for that. So there's always a give and take. The boss thinks that I'm giving you money and I'm just buying your talent. So there is no feeling of you're doing something for me. And nor does an employee think that the organization or the employer is doing anything for me. He's just buying my talent and buying my time. It is factually correct, right? It's not that this fact is wrong. It's not like it's not this way. But can we approach it without thinking of it this way? Can we approach it with gratitude as the basis, right? And if you look at it, it's not something. It's not a very weird idea. Even generations, which was just previous to ours, our parents' generations, our grandparents' generations, you would see this. The relationship between an employee and an employer was completely different, right? Even though they were working, and in fact they were being paid much lesser than what most of us get paid these days. But there would always be that sense of gratitude and sense of duty towards the employer. They would always feel that, you know, this person is giving me a means of life. This person, thanks to him and thanks to the job that he has given me, I am sustaining my family. There will always be that sense of duty and responsibility. And if you go even now to the villages, you would find that there are people who probably will be working as a servant or working as in some of the lower level jobs. They would always have this immense sense of gratitude that even for generations and generations they wouldn't mind serving the same master. And for the master's part, that they will take such good care of their employees because they are offering their services to them. Here again it is a transaction, you know, somebody is offering a service and somebody is paying for that. But that transaction becomes incidental. It is still looked at as someone is taking care of me and I'm grateful to that person. Someone is looking at it as somebody is offering his or her services to me and I'm grateful for that. Can we make our transactions, everything, our interpersonal relations, everything based on this of gratitude, right? Swami would often say this, you know, when even a bus driver, you feel grateful to him because he's helping you commute from one place to the other. Even a watchman, you're grateful to him because he's helping you have a peaceful sleep at night. You don't look at it as, after all, he's doing his job. After all, she's just doing what she is paid for. But you have a sense of gratitude. Swami says, this is a very, very important quality of a spiritual person, this sense of gratitude. In fact, I think I have another question which is lined up, which will come a few weeks down the line, which is about gratitude. I'll probably go a little more into detail about that. But these three aspects of all interpersonal relationships, there should be love, there should be respect and reverence depending on that person's age and status in life and the role that person plays in our life. And thirdly, the sense of duty which is born out of gratitude. The moment we have these three, I think more or less our interpersonal relationships will become more, at least I can say, will tend towards being ideal. Will not necessarily become perfect because there are many other factors involved, but at least it'll start tending towards perfect, right? So this is a very important thing. We can just learn from this one Chinnakatha which Swami is narrating, and it's not just about, as I said, between parents and children. it starts with parents and children, because much of our interaction is with our parents, and for parents, much of the interactions are based on their relationship with their children. So it starts there. A major part of this influences that relationship, but we can extend it to every other relationship that we have, be it between a husband and a wife, between an employer and an employee, like I explained. In fact, interestingly, if you notice, even all our Indian festivals are actually based on this attitude of gratitude, right? You have the Sankranti festival, which is like gratitude to the sun. You have festivals through which we show gratitude to the cow. We show gratitude to the bull. We show gratitude to our tools and implements. We do it during the Ayudha Puja. So everything, even the festivals that we celebrate in the Indian tradition, are based on this idea of gratitude that we must never forget, because that forms the basis of the true essence of Indian culture. Of course, even as I say that, I should tell you that most cultures were like that, right? Most cultures, ancient civilizations, and even modern cultures, you still have Thanksgiving, which is a very, very popular festival, which is of course becoming more of a holiday festival now. But the essence of that is that you need to give thanks to the people who made a difference in your life, to God who has given you whatever that you have. So that gratitude, always having that gratitude at the back of your mind in whatever relationship you're going through. So these two delicate and paradoxical balances have to be maintained. The acceptance of oneness and still having respect for age, achievements and hierarchy. Doing what we do as just part of our duty, and by that way not giving too much importance to it, but remember what others have done to us with gratitude, being grateful to them, and even when they are actually doing their duty, when it comes to our parents or when it comes to anybody who is doing their job taking money. So these two balances, these two delicate balances and literally paradoxical balances, if we can maintain, I think that would be a true sign of what Swami refers to as the Bharatiya nature, right? Then comes the part where in the story, the episode which happens in the temple, where this person seems to have totally lost reverence to this mother goddess who he worshipped so reverentially before he went. Again, here again, there is that attitude of gratitude, which is important, because the father tells, you thank the mother for this opportunity, but now he comes back and seems to have that attitude of gratitude itself is gone, but there is something more to it, which I'll speak about now. And even in that answer which I gave to Ms. Praveena Kilpadi earlier, I made a reference to this, you know, in a country like India, given the many, many challenges that we face, given the huge number of people that live in this land, you know, that quite naturally there are so many uncertainties in life, right? So many uncertainties that even if you're doing your best, even if you are putting your best foot forward, you always need a little bit of extra edge which comes from outside. And that's why it's far more easier to turn to God in a land like India where there are so many uncertainties, right? Of course, it all comes from the culture with which we are brought up, right? If we are brought up being told this, that, you know, you should pray to God because these things can happen and, you know, things can go wrong. So you always pray to God, you do your best, but it does not ensure that you will get the expected results. So for that extra edge, you turn to God. In fact, you know, I recall what would happen in our school, you know, when we would go for these board exams, the 10th and 12th board exams. I recall one of my teachers telling me that, you know, pray well. Of course, you study well, you write and prepare, and all of those instructions will be there. Then she would say that after doing all that you have to do in the name of preparation, always don't forget to pray to God. You know, that's something which she would always tell us. You said, pray to God, because you know, there are so many things that can go wrong. And one of the things that she would say is, pray to God that the examiner who's correcting your paper is in a good mood when he or she is correcting your paper. What's the reason? It's because lakhs and lakhs of students write the board exams in India, and the number of papers that one examiner will have to go through runs into hundreds and thousands. It's like spread out over a few days for an individual who's correcting these papers. And you never know in what mood that person is going to be sitting and correcting your paper. And so this teacher would say that pray to God that whoever is correcting your paper is very lenient, and whoever is correcting your paper is doing so in a very benevolent mood, in a very calm and collected mood. So when there are many uncertainties in life, we very naturally turn to God, right? And where also when it's part of your culture, and we know that in Indian culture, how it is so essentially part of our culture, that turning to God is. So this becomes a very natural thing, right? But of course, given that we are supposed to graduate from this level of turning to God for our needs to the other higher forms of devotion, as we speak of as artha, arthaarthi, and jignasu and jnani. You might start off as an artha and arthaarthi seeking something from God, but eventually you're supposed to move towards these higher states of relationship with God. But nevertheless, Swami says that at least for this you turn to God. And in this land, most people turn to God, and that is what makes this land special. Swami would say Bharatiya means a land where the people are attached to God, right? That's what is, Swami would say, the meaning of the word Bharat. So whether it is for lower fulfillment of desires or for higher purposes, people in this land very naturally turn to God. And for most people, the uncertainties form a very good reason to turn to God. Now what happens when we move to a land of plenty? Move to a land where most things are regularized, right? That's what you see in many of these very well-developed countries. You have processes in place. The number of people who are living there is far lesser than in Indian cities, and it's easy for them to manage, you know. So there is a standard. You know what, how much you have to put in and how much you will get in return. How many hours of work you have to put in, and there are fixed amounts of results that you get. So when the uncertainties start getting removed from our life, if we have not yet graduated to the level of the higher forms of loving God and having a relationship with God, we would find that it's becomes more and more meaningless to hold on to our forms of prayers and our forms of turning to God. And that's what happens many times in people when they go from this life which is filled with uncertainties to a life where pretty much everything is taken care of. The government takes care of your health, the government takes care of your job security, the government takes care of your education and your children's welfare. So you suddenly find that there is no necessity, if I could put it that way, to turn to God. In fact, this is something which one of my classmates was sharing with me when he lived in a Western country, and he came and he was glorifying everything that was about this city. He said, you know, the government does this and it's taken care and all of this. The insurance is there. I mean, he was telling, you know, when you go from an Indian city or from an Indian town to a country like that, it really feels like you've gone into heaven because everything seems to be taken care of. And after giving that description, this friend of mine said, that explains why most people there are atheists, because they don't seem to have any need for God, right? So this is something that can we keep in mind when we move from a land like India and move to not necessarily even a foreign land, but even when our life improves to a state where we have enough money and enough authority and enough power to ensure that these uncertainties do not affect us, can we still hold on to that belief in God, in that relationship with God? I think that also is an essential form of Indian culture. One way that would happen is, as I said, that even when we are turning to God for our necessities and for our lower needs, can we also make this effort to grow into that higher states, from being an artha and artharthi to a jignasu and jnani? Because if the sooner we make that graduation, the sooner we make that movement, then when the surroundings changes around us, when the situation that we are going through in life changes, our relationship with God will not change, right? The other aspect about this relationship with God and this attitude of devotion changing is, the more we intellectualize the way we look at life, the more we intellectualize how creation happens and, you know, we start looking keenly at things, you will realize that it becomes more and more difficult to accept a God-like, you know, being taking care of our lives, and a God-like being whom we have to pray to and who blesses us with grace. It becomes more and more difficult. In fact, you would be very surprised to know that we always speak about Vedanta, right? Predominantly, most schools of Vedanta, be it Sankhya, be it Mimamsa, be it some schools of yoga, most of these very, very philosophical and very, very intellectual forms of Vedanta eventually negate the presence of a being like God. They only speak about how you look at life, you know, how all of us are one, we're all energy, or we're all that same Atma, we're all that same vibration. And we know the Advaita Vedanta, it all starts on the basis of Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya, Jivo Deva Na Apara, which means the individual and the divine are not two separate entities. So where is the question of we praying to an embodied being who's going to give us grace? So the more we intellectualize any concept, we will eventually go towards the absence of an entity called God. But in my opinion, that is the greatest beauty of this land. This land which gave birth to Vedanta, right? This land which is literally gave that Vedantic thought. You know, now you see the quantum mechanic and the advanced physicists coming to these understandings where everything is one and, you know, there is oneness in everything. The more keen you look at it, you come to that conclusion more and more. But this land which gave us that Vedantic thought, which gave us that very, very philosophic and highly intellectual concept where the presence of a being like God is completely negated, this very land is known as Bharat, where the people are attached to God. And this very land has managed to draw that embodiment of divinity every now and then in the form of avatar, one of which we were all so fortunate to witness in our lifetime, right? And I mean, that is the other paradox about the Indian culture. In one hand, you have Vedanta. The more and more we intellectualize, more and more we philosophize, learning, it comes to the point where we don't believe in an embodied being as God. But still, age after age, God has been coming down in different forms to this very land and keeping alive this beautiful expression of love towards God that we refer to as bhakti. So can we maintain this other paradoxical balance? And I think that is also the essence of Indian culture, where you keep the higher understandings in your mind. I'm not saying that we should not believe in Advaita or we should not believe in Vedanta. In fact, I always speak so much about Vedanta in most of my answers. But keep that understanding in the back of your mind, but also realize that there is a being called God. I probably cannot intellectually understand him, but he seems to be making an appearance every now and then in the form of these avatars. So keep this relationship of bhakti, of love and reverence towards this divine being. You know, there is this beautiful analogy which someone says that if you have a wall in front of you, if you ask a physicist what is that wall made of, he's going to tell you that, oh, it's made of atoms. And if you ask him what's an atom made of, the atom is made of, I think, predominantly empty space. No, that's what we study in physics, that an atom is predominantly made of empty space with that heavy nucleus in center, but most of it is empty. So if having that knowledge in our mind, will I look at the wall and say, oh, this wall is an empty space because it's made of atoms, which is predominantly made of empty space, and will I go and ram into that wall? I wouldn't. I might have that intellectual idea in my mind, but in the physical world that I'm living, this wall in front of me being a block, being an obstacle, is a reality to me. So very effortlessly we bridge these two. And I think that's the same thing we have to do in our relationship with God too. Yes, there is that underlying oneness, the underlying idea that there is no God. You know, I see a lot of youngsters who get so fascinated by the Vedantic philosophy or some modern day philosophies in the West, Scientology and things like that. And they find it very, very difficult to come back to a relationship with God, which they've probably grown up with for 20, 25 years. So when I think Swami said, don't come back with those modern ideas, don't be taken up by those modern ideas, I think these are the qualities which Swami was referring to, where you ensure that your relationships are governed by, of course, love. That is essential. That goes without saying. From that, I mean, that beautiful quote that I read today, it's all about love. Right? Love can never be removed from the scene. But in every relationship, along with love, that reverence and respect which defines that physical relationship, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a parent, whether it's a senior in your office, whether it's a senior colleague or a boss, a reverence and respect which defines that physical relationship, and the sense of gratitude and duty, which is literally one and the same, the sense of duty which comes from the feeling of gratitude. Can we maintain that in every relationship, in how at home, in society, and at workplace. And the third thing is, as much as possible, hold on to this idea of God. You know, literally keep God as that central pole that we tie ourselves to. Explore the world, explore philosophies. If you want to listen to something which is about a new age philosophy which talks about atheism, you can listen to it. You know, that's what I said. The Indian school of Vedanta is filled with ideas of atheism. But people did not fear that because somehow God centered the people of this land around him through the act of devotion, through his grace of coming down in the form of an avatar. So as Indians, if we want to retain that Bharatiya nature, intellectualize. And that's why Swami would say that, you know, have the head of Shankara, that's all right. You can have Advaita in your head. But in your heart, always treasure that feeling of love for God. I feel this is what it is when Swami said that you go abroad but don't come back as a foreigner, but come back retaining that Indianness in you. As I said, this is definitely not comprehensive. There's so much to speak about what Swami refers to as Indianness. But these are very, very important things. These are things which Swami often repeats in some of his discourses. And, you know, it's so fascinating that just from one Chinnakatha we can learn so much, isn't it? So Brother Saideek, thank you very, very much for asking this question. I think it's a very beautiful question. The last time when I answered the question on Indianness, I got a couple of mails saying that it would be wonderful if you can speak more, because the way I concluded that answer, it did appear that there was so much more to speak, and people said that it would be nice that if you can have another session where you speak about this topic. So Brother Saideek, your question gave us that opportunity, so thank you for that. And thank you on behalf of these other listeners who told me that it would be nice to hear more about this. If you have anything more to ask on the topic that I've spoken or any other question, feel free to write to me again. So with that, dear listeners, it's time to wrap up this week's show of Radio Sai Answering Booth. If you have a question like Brother Saideek, it would be wonderful if you can send it across. You can send it to me to my mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. This is my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to this ID will be read by me. So if you wish to be anonymous, if you don't want your name to be mentioned, but your question to be answered, you can let me know. I'll do likewise. It would be amazing if you can send me the question in your own voice, record it, because that way I can get to play a different voice on the show, and I'm sure it must be boring to listen to me all through, so at least a little bit of break where we can listen to a different voice. So it would be wonderful if you can send it in your own voice. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I thank him for this opportunity that he's giving week after week to dive into his message and to learn more and more. And I thank you all for this opportunity, because thanks to all of your questions, I'm having this opportunity of reading into Swami's message.
Sai Ram, you just heard an episode of our radio program, Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem from Team Radio Sai at 7:30 p.m. Indian Standard Time on Thursdays. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 31st August 2017. Dear listeners, we hope you like this program. As always, send us your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and Sai Ram from Prashant Nilayam.